Welcome to Tips from the Server Room. This podcast is designed for all you systems admins, network specialists, or the guys and gals out there in the office who handles it all. Sit back, relax, grab a beverage, and enjoy Tips from the Server Room. Hey, yes, good evening and welcome back, my friends, to Tips from the Server Room. This is episode number 48, and tonight's show is coming to you live and in living color on May 27th, 2014. I'm yours, Jack, and I'm going to help guide you through this magical world of networks, connected items, and all things server goodness. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast. If it's tech, it's here. You can check out Tech Podcast at techpodcast.com. Please check out our website if you haven't done so already. I would really appreciate it if you stop over there. And you can check that website out at www.tipsfromtheserverroom. That's tipsfromtheserverroom.com, where you can comment on these shows. You can also leave us a voicemail message, which some of you have been doing, and I truly appreciate that. And that voicemail line is 724-701-0550. 724-701-0550. If you have any questions or ideas for future shows, you can send those to me to my email. And my email address is jackstechcorner@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, and I hope that you do that. Many of you have been, and I do truly appreciate that. You can follow me on Twitter as at Technoman. That's TechNoMan. We're trying something new tonight. We tried this in the past a little bit, and it didn't seem to go over too big. But I figure I'm going to start doing it again, just because I have the streaming service set up, and I figured, hey, why not use it? Each week, we'll be streaming the recording of Tips from the Server Room live. And that is on the service live stream. Please follow me on Twitter to learn when the live streams are going live. You'll receive an announcement when I go live. You can also check out the recordings on live stream. I think they keep these up for about 30 days. You can go to the site, to my account site, and that is at https://new.livestream.com/accounts/554235. I'm also going to put that link in our show notes on the website. So if you're like, well, Jack, I'm in the car. I couldn't write that down, obviously. What I want you to do then is just check out our website at tipsfromtheserverroom.com, and I will have it there available for you. Tonight's beer is a beer called Hopper, H-O-O-P-E-R, I-P-A, for that bold, hoppy taste. It is a refreshing beer, but it's not something that I found the other day that you'd want to drink after mowing the lawn. It's just not really that great for mowing the lawn beer, you know what I mean? So I wouldn't use it for that. But anyway, other than that, it's a really good, tasty brew. Tonight we're going to start off here with some emails, and I just think, get started here with some email messages. And this first one actually comes to us from Todd. Todd's written in before to the show quite a few times. And I do appreciate that, Todd, every week. I do read your emails and, pay close attention to what you have to say. I tried to get Todd on the show, but if you remember, Todd said, look, let's leave the podcasting up to the podcasters. And that's fine by me, no problem. But I can still get his message across to you. Todd is talking about last week's show. Now, if you listened to last week's show, I didn't get any comments. I told you that I was doing that out of a hotel room. And I recorded with a little Samsung Go microphone. Now, if you've never seen that little microphone, it's pretty cool. It's very, very small. It clips on a laptop, and you can use it. It's a little condenser mic, and it works very well. So you might want to check out last week's show just for the audio content to see how the audio worked out with the USB microphone. Anyway, Todd wanted to talk about last week's show, and he says, starts off, once again, what a great show. You asked us to write in about databases, and I feel the need to ramble on. I apologize in advance for my email is not cohesive, but it is. It's very straightforward. Our company has a combination of MS underscore SQL clusters and standalone databases. We also have Enterprise Oracle and standalone Oracle databases on our network. I do not handle the day-to-day, as we have a team of 15 that handle those demands. I am coming at this from a security standpoint. From my previous writing, I do not believe I'm an expert, but just passing along some information that has worked for me. Our SQL servers are on a segmented network behind a firewall from the rest of the network. We only allow certain servers that have a need to connect to the SQL servers, which are mainly application servers and web services, but are also only limited to certain ports. We never put our databases on a web server that is extremely facing to point to the backend SQL server. The web servers are on a DMZ or a demilitary zone, how's that one? On another firewall, and our internal network, which is workstations and other clients, are on another segment. We also do not allow the workstations access to these servers, as we trust workstations least of all other devices. Regarding your discussion on the use of the SAID, we never use them, but set them with extreme complex passwords, and we change them often. For applications that need, we always create separate IDs with limited access or domain user IDs with limited access. And let me put a cursor here because I'm going to stop that for a minute. The only thing bad about that, because we've done that in the past, and the only thing I found out bad about that is when you set these accounts up, there's many, many applications that's connected to your SQL servers. And with that said, if you change or if you redo the SA password, we talked about that last week, the systems administrator password for your database server, you have to remember to go to each one of those applications and also change it there. If you do not, you will run into the problem that the applications will no longer communicate with your database backend. That has happened to me, so I've learned from experience. Let's continue. Over the last 20 years, I cannot tell you how many vendors think we have to either use SA or an ID with the same level for their applications. I have also never met vendor applications that we cannot get working with limited access or force the vendor to make it work. With all that said, we do understand that if and when our web services or application servers are compromised, and they will be as well as servers, will eventually be hacked, we may have enough time to treat the extensive data loss, and they'll be able to find that based on the account usage. So that's a very good policy. Now for security monitoring. We use an enterprise tool that does vulnerability scans, monitors uses of SA and or attempts, and other user IDs on our network that attempt to access a database. I can go into these tools, but they are priced well over the average house. And if your company has the budget, you're probably running one of these products already. Before we had all of those expensive tools, I had to do a lot of this with free and low-cost tools. One of my favorite free tools that I use for more than just database is Nmap. You can find it at nmap.org. Now, Nmap is a great tool for port scanning, network discovery, system discovery such as OS detection, vulnerability detection, backdoor detection, and vulnerability exploration. This can also be done via the command line and a GUI called Zenmap. It's Zenmap. Nmap also has scripts for looking at SQL, and here are some links. And I will add these links into today's show notes. So if you go to tipsfromtheserverroom.com and you look for this current show that we are currently producing here, we will find the notes here for show number 48, and I will have all these links there. Another great tool is SQL Map. You can find it at sqlmap.org. And of course, a great one for Microsoft products is Microsoft Baseline Security Analyzer, and I will also include that link in the show for this particular week. So if you, again, if you go to tipsfromtheserverroom.com, you will find those links and you can check out all those scripts and everything else. Todd, I have to thank you from the bottom of my heart, as well as the listeners and the viewers of this show. And we're very glad that you're there. We're very glad that you keep bringing us more information and keep doing so. And just keep emailing it to whatever address you're using. I know you asked me earlier which email address I'd rather use. If you use jackstechcorner@gmail.com, I will also get those. This email message came to me as I was actually just finished up dinner tonight. And I was telling my wife, I picked up my phone. I looked, I said, oh, there's a great email for tonight's show. And she said, well, that's perfect timing. And I said, you're right. So I figured I would put this one on tonight's show. This is from Eduardo. Now, he writes that he is having a problem. Now, this I titled this Multiple Web Services on One External IP Address because I believe that a lot of this is going on with a lot of you out there, especially if you work like I do on some consulting projects, and I work with some smaller companies and smaller offices. They usually aren't allotted a lot of IP addresses. Even at the school I work at, I believe right now we're allotted maybe 30. And some schools have asked for more. Some schools have asked for a whole Class C block. And I said, why would you need 254 some addresses to run your network? Really? And I just think that's crazy. But anyway, we do a lot of this, what I'm going to mention tonight on this email, to try to help you along with this, Eduardo. So it starts out, I have a problem and I hope you can help me. When you get a chance, here's our chance to help you right here. So if you listen to the podcast, hopefully you are. And I will definitely email this gentleman back. Here at home, I host a website at 10.0.0.11. This is also my domain controller, my DNS server, all Windows 2008 R2. I can access the site, the website, from outside my network just fine. It's also the same domain as my email. The question is that I have, how can I access my Exchange, OWA, or its Outlook Web Agent, from outside as well? My Exchange server is on a different server. It's on 10.0.0.15. The Link server, LINC server, is on 10.0.0.13. 10.0.0.13. From which the Exchange server intranet URL, the intranet URL, is exchange dot, and then he gives his website. I won't give those out. He was just sending those to me. And the Link server is, and he gives me his Link server, and it starts out link dot, and then his domain name. When setting up Link users, subdomains, admins. I have my router and firewall set to point to port 80 and port 443 for HTTPS traffic to 10.0.0.11 because I need HTTPS on this web server setting on my 10.0.0.11 IP address. So my problem is just that I cannot think of a way to route subdomains such as exchange.hisdomain coming from outside to the Exchange server 10.0.0.15. Basically, I have multiple sites on different machines and I only have one external IP address. Am I out of luck? Or is there a way to make the domain controller route these subdomain sites internally so the outside user can access those? Thanks in advance, Eduardo. Well, this is a wonderful, wonderful question. And this is why I started doing this podcast to begin with, to kind of pay it forward, to kind of help people out there that's having these type of issues that don't quite just understand how you would do this. And as I just said, we have about 30 IP addresses on 30 routable IP addresses. Now, I know we get a little techie on this show. A lot of you listen because it is techie, techie, and I've received emails that said, Jack, you're just too techie for me, and you just, you know, we need to back it down a little bit. Anyway, with that said, the techie side is going to come out now. Inside our network, we have currently multiple servers, multiple workstations, maybe even multiple printers that you may need to get in from the outside, and you need to do this stuff. So what happens is you have to be able to, you only have one outside address. How do you get to these internal servers? The first thing you must have an outside DNS server. Unless your DNS server, which I wouldn't recommend it, don't make your DNS server the root. So don't take your outside IP address and on your DNS record for your hosting service, don't make that your root DNS server. I tell everybody I know to use a service called zoneedit.com, ZoneEdit.com. I've been using them for years. And what's nice about ZoneEdit is you can set up a free account, and I believe you get three zones. A zone is basically consisted of a domain name, is what a zone is. So if you have abc.com, cde.com, and xyz.com, those can all be separate zones. Once you get above three, then you have to pay for their service, which is very, very inexpensive, and it's a very great way to route your. The reason is we don't want two things we don't want. One, we don't want all those DNS queries coming through our internet. I don't want those coming through my router, my internet line. It just takes up, it's a lot of traffic coming through. Second, you're opening up a avenue of approach for people and you're giving your outside IP address to the world at that point. Another pretty bad idea. So use ZoneEdit or another service like them. You may even have, I know if you use, I use one-on-one hosting services. You may use a service like GoDaddy. Any of those companies out there probably have DNS services for you. So you can say that my main DNS server or my hosting DNS server is GoDaddy or, you know, whatever their IP address is. But what you want to do, here is the key element here. It is called port forwarding. Now, you did a good job on using port 80 and port 443 for 10.0.0.11, and you're going to forward those through. So my outside address, let's say my outside address is 70.0.0.0. I would use a colon, port 80. And then 72.0.0.80, whatever that outside address I just said, colon 443. And I would map those back. I would do a static mapping and static map those back to 10.0.0.11. Now for your email traffic, you have to get the port, and I didn't look it up. Just do a Google search for ports for your email server, for your Exchange email. I believe it's probably 110 for the POP side and probably 25 for your SMTP. What you want to do there, and I'm not sure what the actual client there, your OWA client is, but what you could do with that, if it's also port 80, what you're going to need to do is pick a off port number. So if our normal port, our normal web port is port 80, we know this, we would want to take that OWA and set up the port maybe 88 or maybe even off, maybe port 90. Doesn't really matter. What matters is you just have that port number in there. So when you're routing people through your firewall and you say, look, I want you to go to 72.0.0.whatever your outside IP address is, and then you want to say, I want to make that a static, and I want to go to my email server, which would be 10.0.0.15. And then you do something like an EQ, which means equal, and then you put your port number, port 110, port 85, port 90, whatever you use for that OWA account, and then you'll be absolutely fine. Do the same with your link, your LINC service, which I've heard of link. I don't use it, so I'm not real familiar with it, but I'm sure there is a port number. And if it's a web interface, you're going to have to make it again, another port number, and route it back to that internal IP address. Folks, you can have basically as many services running as you can possibly think across one outside IP address. All you have to do is do some port forwarding and make sure you use the port number to get you back. Again, use something like ZoneEdit or something for your DNS hosting services, and then you will be good to go. It's very straightforward. Take your time, Eduardo. If you have any more questions, you can email those to me, I'll try to maybe lay that out a little bit more clear for you, but hopefully that's going to help you. And I think once you get started and do some Google searches on port forwarding, man, you're going to be flying through this because you already have all this stuff in your house. You obviously know what you're doing. You have a good knack for setting up servers and all these different services, and you're using Exchange. I have to say, bless you very much. I think Exchange is a wonderful program, but we often say that if you want to run Exchange in a company, you almost have to be an Exchange engineer. I mean, there's just so many working parts to that. And a lot of you folks know out there that I use Google Apps now for the school. That's what we've been using now for about the past 6 or 7 years. And all my MX records by email and everything is all pointing to Google servers, and I don't have to worry about that nightmare. And I know there's some other podcasters out there, Mike, that I listen to all the time, talks a lot about Google App servers, but for education, it's wonderful because we pay nothing for it. And now that we're using Google Chromebooks, it's just a piece of cake to set all that up for us, and it works really, really well. If you are a company out there, and I believe Mike has it right, I really do, because I think what he talks about a lot is the cost of that. And the cost is getting overwhelming because they're charging their corporate customers, and like they give it away free for education for colleges. It's free. But they do charge their corporate customers a good bit of money. So at that point, you may be, and I would probably even suggest, to go to something like an offsite Exchange server. You may look at 1&1. They have a great mail packages. GoDaddy has great mail packages. And there's other companies out there that will offer email over the web at a very, very discounted rate from the Google Apps. So tonight's segment, we are going to jump right in here. Eduardo, thank you very much for that question. I'm sorry, I forgot to thank you there. I really do appreciate it. And anybody else out there, remember, if you have any questions, you want to email those in to me, send those to jackstechcorner@gmail.com. jackstechcorner@gmail.com. All right, let's take a little sip there of beer. Take a breather. And we will get back underway. So tonight we're going to be talking in this show about using NLB. Now, I've talked about NLB in the past, or not really even NLB. I've talked about load balancing in the past. And tonight we're going to talk about network load balancing. Now, we're going to be digging into Microsoft's NLB, and I want to give you some of the ins and outs of its uses. If you're not load balancing, then now's a good time to think about it. And with NLB, it couldn't be easier. It could not be easier than actually just walking through the steps and setting it all up. Matter of fact, I'll be looking into this probably even more tomorrow on my network. I won't have a show in a link. I will have a link in the show notes. So you'll have a link to the website that I used. It is a TechNet article that I found that I'll be telling you about load balancing tonight. And it just gives me a really nice squared up approach to bringing this podcast to you and allowing me to present it in an orderly fashion. So that's why I like using these different websites. Now, this does apply to Windows Server 2008 R2 and Windows Server 2012 R2. The network load balancing, or NLB feature, in Windows Server enhances the availability and scalability of your internet service applications, such as those used in web, FTP, firewall, proxy, VPNs, or other mission-critical servers. A single computer running Windows Server provides a limited level of server reliability and scalability performance. However, by combining the resources of two or more computers running one of the products in Windows Server into a single virtual cluster, NLB can deliver the reliability and performance that web servers and other mission-critical servers needed. Wow, maybe I should have did this podcast back when they were creating healthcare.gov. maybe then the people that created that, that got all that money, and think of that, guys. How many of you out there are listening, scratching your head going, I could have did that. I could have wrote that PHP SQL backend. I could have used load balancing. I could have got paid millions and millions and millions of dollars. I'm sure you are. I'm sure you're thinking that right now, going, man, could have made all that money. We could have teamed up together. Everybody listening to this podcast, we could have put our brains together and came up with something for that. But I don't think they were load balancing. I think they set up one, you know, Windows 2008 R2 server in a corner somewhere of the of a bedroom, and the kid goes, good, pay me $20 million. And they did. I mean, why wouldn't you go to Google for that? Why wouldn't you go to Google or Yahoo or Microsoft, even Apple, and say, hey, help us design this? They have great engineers. They will help you through this stuff. Okay, let's move on. Each host runs a separate copy of the desired server application, such as applications for web, FTP, or telnet services. NLB distributes incoming client requests across the host in the cluster. A load weight to be handled by each host can be configured as necessary. You can also add hosts dynamically to the cluster to handle increased load. In addition, NLB can handle direct all traffic to the designated single host, which is called the default host. MLB allows all the computers in the cluster to be addressed by the same set of cluster IP addresses, and it maintains a set of unique, dedicated IP addresses for each host. When the host fails or goes offline, the load is automatically redistributed among the computers that are still operating. When a computer fails or goes offline unexpectedly, active connections to the failed or offline server are lost. However, if you bring the host down intentionally, you can use what's called the drain stop command to service all active connections prior to bringing the computer offline in any case, when it is ready, the offline computer can transparently rejoin the cluster and regain its share of the workload, which allows the other computers in the cluster to handle less traffic. Now, this is really nice. And when I've been reading through this stuff and digging in more into load balancing and clustering, they say, like, when we do so much what we do in our field, when we're setting up stuff like RAID servers, we're always talked about using the same gear, the same equipment. They'll talk to you when you're building a VMware cluster or a VMware farm. You know, all hardware, all the servers should be equally balanced to their hardware, to the memory, and to the processor. But with this setting up NLB, you can use multiple servers, different kinds of servers, and allow that activity to stroll across those different servers. Here's one thing that I would have to think about. This is something that you should probably run around through your head. It may be a question for some of you out there that are doing load balancing and talking about load balancing in your networks. And it is basically this question. When you are setting up NLB, now I would think that you wouldn't want to set these up on virtual servers. Let's say, for instance, if we have one physical box and we have four virtual servers, you're still really only using the processing power of the physical box. I would think it would be more better off or better to do is to use three or four different physical boxes and then spread that out, spread your load balancing over. Because if you have all four NLB servers running on one physical box, it seems to me like it would strain the central processor unit of that or the RAM or whatever's in there. And I know you can virtually make it more, but I think that would be the common denominator there. All right, so the hosts in an NLB cluster exchange heartbeat messages to maintain constant data about the cluster membership. By default, when a host fails to send a heartbeat message within 5 seconds, it has failed. When a host has failed, the remaining hosts in the cluster coverage, and they do the following. They establish which hosts are still active members of the cluster. They elect the host with the highest priority as the new default host. and they ensure that all new client requests are handled by the surviving hosts. So that's pretty important also, is talking about how the host actually pick up where the other host actually leaves off. I mean, that's really key there. So you have to really worry about that overall. And, you know, when you're looking at the way the clusters handle, excuse me, because you know that currently what's going to happen is our current setup is we have one server running our web. Actually, our web services are, again, off-site, because you know I like off-site hosting pretty much more than anything except my domain controllers and some of my internal web hosting services. But most of my stuff is handled off-site. That's just the way I really like to do stuff. But what we need to think about here is we need to establish that connectivity. Remember, as I said again, the healthcare.gov website, there was no consistency, no failover. So when they started getting, 200 million requests every second, obviously couldn't handle that. And think of it this way. Wonder if you become under attack with a DOS attack, a denial of services attack, and somebody just wants to take your company's website down for fun or whatever. If you have NLB set up, and if that clustering can pick up and start covering all of those requests, chances are you may not go down. Another really good way to remedy that, and we haven't really talked about this, I think, in any past shows, is mirroring your website. Have your website in a whole nother hosting package somewhere, wherever. If I used to do this when I had multiple locations. I worked for a private school for about 4 years, and we had 5 locations. Well, I had high-speed internet coming into 2 of my main locations, and what we had a mirrored web server at the second location. So if our main web server would go down, our DNS would point you to the secondary web hosting server. It wasn't a cluster for load balancing. It was more just I wanted a fail-safe routine for the purpose of if I got attacked, if our school got attacked and somebody wanted to take down our website, I want somewhere else for it to go. So that's a way to do that. But it wasn't really this. It wasn't load balancing. Now, during a convergent, the surviving hosts look for consistent heartbeats. If the host that failed to send the heartbeats begins to provide heartbeats consistently, it will rejoin the cluster in the course of the convergent. Once a new host attempts to join the cluster, it sends heartbeat messages that also trigger a convergent. After all cluster hosts agree on the current cluster membership, the client load is redistributed to the remaining hosts and the convergent completes. Convergent generally takes only a few seconds, so interruptions in client service by the cluster is minimal. During convergence, hosts that are still active continue handling client requests without attracting existing connections, without affecting existing connections. Convergent ends when all hosts report a consistent view of the cluster membership and distribution map for several heartbeat periods. Now, remember, there says it only takes a few seconds. Well, remember, it's looking for a 5-second interval is what these clusters are looking for. If it doesn't see a heartbeat within 5 seconds, it no longer talks to that actual cluster. That one's actually just ignored, and the other ones pick up. Folks, this is extremely helpful information to set up your clients this way. I would also suggest, it says web services, so really, really dig in. Take a hard look at your email servers. That's a web service. And dig into it and see how you can set up NLB. Network load balancing. You know, because email, as much as our young people today really don't even see email as being important, if you own a company in several years, start learning more about Twitter, start learning more about Instagram, and text messaging. Because when you start hiring these young people today, when they're coming into your workforce, I know my daughter's 18 now. And I talked to her about her internet use. I said, well, how much do you use email? Only when I email, the teachers. Because the kids say the teachers are older, and I fall into this group where people email me help desk tickets because I look at my email. But people today, young people want more of a rapid response. Everything's rapid. So in your business, some years down the road, not too far in the future, you're going to be starting to see these people coming in wanting to use instant Twitter messages or a Facebook group message or something in that effect. Try to embrace that, because that is the future of our communications. And if you're in this business, guys and girls out there, if you're in this technology business that we're involved in, stuff that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, if you are not watching electronic communications, you need to get your head wrapped around that very seriously. And the reason we need to is because we need to know what we are going to be supporting in the future. Unless you're 60 or 65, you say, Jack, I'm getting ready to retire. I don't really care. I was here for the dot-com bubble. I was here for the dot-com burst. And I was here when email became, remember when email first started with those weird ANSI windows we used, and you'd type it, and it wasn't pretty or anything, but it went through. And that was our fast message. Remember when email started, we used to write letters to each other and put them in the mailbox. Well, kids want rapid response. That's what kids want nowadays. I work with many of them, and I got a good understanding of that. So if you don't have a good understanding of communications in the electronic age, start wrapping yourself up to it. Learn a little bit about Instagram. Learn a little bit about, if you're probably on Facebook or Google Plus. That's another good one. I'm on both of those. Twitter, obviously, I told you my Twitter name earlier. So you want to get on Twitter, and you want to follow that also, because these are the pathways to our future communications. So check it out. See if NLB will help, though, in your email system. Because if that email goes down, you are belly up. Your services will go down, and there's not much you can do about it. I mean, when email goes down, that is why I off-site host. And if you go back some shows, I don't even remember which show it was. I talked about the benefits and the cons, the pros and cons of either hosting your email or having an in-house email server. Years ago, back in the 90s, I owned my own internet service provider business. We provided dial-up internet services. So you know that was a little while ago. But we knew that we had to keep the email services running. That was critical for everybody's business out there. So it's very, very important to be able to do that. All right, so why are we talking about this with the improvements of Windows Server 2008 R2 and Windows Server 2012 R2? Extended affinity. The extended option preserves client affinity where the configuration of an NLB cluster is changed. This option also allows clients to keep affinity to a cluster host, so they're affiliated or affinity to the host, even if there are no active existing connections from the client to the host. Windows PowerShell for NLB clusters. Windows PowerShell is a new command line shell for scripting languages. And to be honest, I have not wrapped myself around it. I'm still using the old scripting languages, the old VB scripts. That's what I'm used to. I'm an old timer that came up the old ways, folks. And that's what I really like using. But Windows PowerShell, you need to wrap your head around that and learn it. It's even more powerful than VB scripting, so I've been told. But it accelerates automation of systems administrative tasks. You can use Windows PowerShell to manage NLB clusters. For more information using PowerShell, check out this web link, and it will be in the show notes. I got a lot of stuff to put in the show notes tonight. I'm sure I'll be doing that for quite a while after the show's over. Support for rolling upgrades. NLB support rolling upgrades from Windows Server 2003 to Windows Server 2012 R2, and from Windows Server 2008 to Windows Server 2012 R2. For deployment information of NLB, including information on rolling upgrades, again, this link will be in the show notes. Let's see here what else I wanted to touch base on with you. Scalability. Scalability is the measure of how well a computer or service or application can grow to meet the increasing performance demands. For NLB clusters, scalability is the ability to incrementally add one or more systems to an existing cluster when the overall load of the cluster exceeds its capabilities. To support scalability, NLB can do the following. It can balance load requests across the NLB clusters for individual TCP/IP services. It can support up to 32 computers in a single cluster. Remember we talked before about physical versus virtual machines? So this can support up to 32 computers for a single cluster. You can balance multiple server load requests from either the server client or from several clients across multiple hosts in a cluster. Support the ability to add hosts to the MLB cluster as a load goes up without bringing the cluster down. Well, that's pretty important. Support the ability to remove hosts from a cluster when the load goes down. You can enable high performance and low overhead through fully pipelined implementation. Pipelining allows requests to be sent to the MLB cluster without waiting for a response from the previous sent one. Also, we're shooting for high availability. Folks, that's what we do on a daily basis. And I tell my guys that work for me, we sit down, we'll have a meeting once a week, and we talk about how has the availability been. And they know, I don't want to know just the server availability. I want to know how's the wireless availability been. What's the talk out in the schools? What are people saying about the end user experience? We want to know this stuff. We want high availability. We now do host servers in our rack that are up 24 hours, 7 days a week. And you know, school ends usually at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And we are normally, the schools, there's no way they're on the weekends. And there's no way they're over the holiday break. But what we do run is we run gradebook services out of our servers. And what that means is we have parents, family, friends, whoever of the child logging into those servers all hours of the day, the night, the weekend, and everything else. We also host things like lunch menus. We got to worry about that. So even though I don't have my website hosted locally, I am still responsible for a ton of web services. And that's where we talk about high availability. A highly available system reliably provides an acceptable level of service with minimal downtime. To provide high availability, NLB includes built-in features that can automatically detect and recover from a cluster host that fails or goes offline, balance the network load when hosts are added or removed, recover and redistribute the workload within 10 seconds. That's pretty amazing stuff, 10 seconds. Manageability. NLB provides the following manageability features. You can manage and configure multiple NLB clusters and the cluster host from a single computer by using the NLB manager. You can specify the load balancing behavior from a single IP port or group of ports by using the port management rules. You can define different port rules for each website. If you use the same set of load balance servers for multiple applications or websites, port rules are based on the destination virtual IP address using virtual clusters. You can direct all client requests to a single host by using optional single host rules. NLB routes client requests to the particular host that is running the specific applications. You can block undesirable network access to a certain IP port. You can enable Internet Group Management Protocol, IGMP, support on the cluster host to control switch flooding, which operating in multiple and multicast mode, which I really dislike a lot, and I could tell you tons of reasons why. I'll give you one mainly when I'm done reading this. You can remotely start, stop, and control NLB actions from any networked computer that is running Windows by using shell commands or scripts. You can view the Windows event log to check NLB events. NLB logs all actions and cluster changes in the event log. And why did I say that I don't really like multicast mode? Because we used to use the program, which a lot of you may use for imaging, called Ghost. I did a show, I think early on, maybe one of my first or second shows when I started this podcast, and I showed you some different applications that we use now for imaging our computers. But we set up Ghost over the summer 1 year, and we set it up in a multicast mode. Now, in the summer, we have minimal use on our networks. We have some office staff working, some maybe building principals, some administration. And what happens is we set that up multicast mode and we started a lab of computers imaging. And we thought, hey, this is all great and everything's going perfect. Wonderful day. Well, once the images started rolling out, we started receiving phone calls. The network was being flooded. Our switches were being flooded by all this multicast traffic. And since then, I have not been a fan of Ghost, and I have not been a fan of multicast mode. I would rather use single mode all day and just run my switches the way they need to run in their happy-go-lucky little way. So that is why I don't like multicast, and you guys may find it easy to use. We find now what we like to do with imaging. We have multiple external hard drives. We go in a lab, and we can knock out 30 computers in about, you know, maybe 4 hours, I would say, give or take, depending on how many we get running at a time. We like to run 5, and we'll go and do something else, come back and switch that to another 5 and rename those, and we'll do all that. And we'll talk about that someday, because somebody mentioned to me once about SysPrep. We'll talk about SysPrep in another show. Ease of use. Let's talk about a little bit of ease of use for NLB. NLB provides many features that make it convenient to use. NLB is installed on a standard Windows networking driver component. NLB requires no hardware changes to enable it and run it. NLB Manager enables you to create new NLB clusters pretty much on the fly. NLB Manager enables you to configure and manage multiple clusters and all the cluster hosts from a single remote or a local computer. NLB lets clients access the cluster by using a single logical internet name and or a virtual IP address known as the cluster IP address. It retains individual names for each computer. NLB allows multiple virtual IP addresses for multi-homed servers. In the case of virtual clusters, the servers do not need to be multi-homed to have a multiple virtual IP address. NLB can be bound to multiple network adapters, and that's nice. That helps with that load. That's very important. We talked about that in a couple of shows in the past, which allows you to configure multiple independent clusters on each host. Support for multiple host network adapters differs from virtual clusters in that virtual clusters allow you to configure multiple clusters on a single network adapter. So we can either have one cluster on multiple adapters, or we can have multiple adapters and have those, no wait, or have multiple clusters on a single adapter. So you can have one adapter on multiple clusters or multiple clusters on a single adapter. So it almost sounds like we are going back to that whole thing we talked about virtualizing. Should you run virtual machines on this? I would still stick to physical hardware. That's just my preference. You guys let me know what you're doing. I'd really love to hear out there what the field is doing and give me that feedback I need so I can share that with the rest of the audience. You do not have to modify server applications to run in an NLB cluster. So the application is just going to run normally. They don't really need to know that back end, what's going on and where we're going to be residing. We don't need to create multiple directories and all that stuff for all those different hosts and packages. Just let the NLB do it and let it take its case there. You can take computers offline for preventative maintenance without disturbing the cluster's operations on the other host. That's another reason why I like virtual servers and VMware, because I can pull down a physical machine, I can work on it, put it back, and not disturb anybody. They can still be working. That saves us, the technologists, from being in the shop, right, at 8 o'clock at night till midnight. One weekend I did go in some years ago. I went in to do a Windows Server upgrade. My wife said, will you be home to go to the movie with me and the kids? I said, yeah, I'm sure I'll be home to be in time for the movies. Yep, famous last words. I upgraded that Windows Server. I think it was a 2008 R2 server, and I was running the patches and upgrades and whatever. For whatever reason, I lost all network connectivity to it. So I had to go in and find out how to uninstall all those fixes and hot patches. And I had to end up actually, I think I actually reloaded that server that day or upgraded or something. Well, as the story went, the wife and the kids went to the movies, and I didn't get to go. So I got to listen to some Pandora at work as that was all going on. All right. So hopefully you understand now more about NLB, network load balancing, and you can wrap your head around it a little bit anyway. and pick up a little bit more about NLB. It's a great way to load balance. It seems like it's very configurable. It's very easy to use. Since doing this show, actually, I'll be digging more into it. I mean, we've always load balanced our servers, but we've never really load balanced our web services. So we'll be digging more into that, I'm sure, at work. So I want to thank you very much for joining me here each week. I want to thank you. I can't thank you enough for downloading these shows. The numbers have been really great, you know, astronomical at times, more than I thought you guys and girls out there would be listening to the show. And I have to thank, like I said, again, I'm going to throw it back to techpodcast.com, because since they invited me into their realm of tech podcast, I have found you guys. So we kind of had like a marriage made in heaven, I guess. The tech people are now listening to the tech podcast. So I think it's a great marriage. It can't be any better. I will ask you, and I know that the other podcasters out there, I'm sure, have asking you also. So maybe spread the love around, I would say. Whenever you're shopping on Amazon for any reason, for whatever you're buying, if you're buying not just a server or a network cable, if you're buying something for your car wax, for your car, you're buying cleaning products for your house on Amazon, go to my website, tipsfromtheserverroom.com, click on your ad blocker and unblock my ads, because I know a lot of you out there use ad blocker. We're not totally crazy. We know what's going on in the world. And look for my Amazon link on that page. Use that Amazon link when you're buying anything. It helps to support these shows, and I can't thank you enough for using that. We're trying to see that come up this year, and I want to get more and more of you using that Amazon link. And if you use others, that's fine. I can understand, but maybe spread the love. Buy something from them, and when you're buying something more expensive, buy it from me. I'm just kidding. Anyway, folks, and I want to thank everybody out there who's been signing up for my Windows Server courses. I can't thank you enough. There's so many of you out there that are starting to come through and joining these server courses to learn some more. Maybe you're just trying to pick up some new pointers. Maybe you've been doing servers for years and you're like, I want to know a little bit more about this. So remember, if you don't have high-speed internet, you can still order the DVDs. They are available. It's Windows Server 2008 R2 or Windows Server 2012 R2. You can buy the DVDs at jackstechcorner.com. And I usually ship those the next business day. So when you order them, they're usually out in the mail back to you. But folks, if you want to learn Windows Server 2008 R2, Windows Server 2012, or VMware ESXi Server from A to Z, from install to administration, please sign up for one of my courses, and you can sign up for those at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. That's tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Look for the online class link at the top of the page, and then click on the course that you're interested in. The courses are self-paced. You watch a video and you take a short quiz. And don't say, oh, Jack, I hear this every week. I get emails. Oh, Jack, I've been out of school for 30 years. That's okay. I've been out of school for a long time also. If I could create these, I'm sure you can answer them. Guaranteed. Once you complete the course, I will mail your certificate. I did have an email that said, Jack, will these help get me ready for the Microsoft cert? These are not cert-based, so they will start giving you the pointers and get you ready. But I do recommend that you also pick up some supplemental reading for the Microsoft certification courses. But these will get you going, get you on the ball, and get you ready for the low price that we have going for these courses. Once again, you can sign up for those courses at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Folks, make sure you check the link for the live show. Like I said, I'm going to be hosting this show each week at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'd like to get some of you in there and some of you chatting on the show and stuff. This week, I looked at the numbers. We've had no live viewers, but just trying to push this out to you there, and you're not going to pick us up in the podcast, and you're not going to hear that it is live. I do a live photography show on Sunday mornings, and we usually have, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20 or 30 people that drop into that show. So it's nice, but sign up for livestream.com if you want to chat, and you can get in there. You can watch the show. You get notified when I go live. You'll get an email blast. I also put it on Twitter. So that's about it for this week. Thanks, everybody, once again, for joining me and subscribing and downloading to the show. And if you can, if you're pulling us off iTunes, again, go over there and put a little comment in. Give it a little 4 or 5-star rating and put a little comment in. Hey, I like the show. I'm learning something. Or maybe something I can do better. Email me and let me know, and I will definitely try to curve my ways. All right, folks, thanks. Have a great work week, and I'll see you back here next Tuesday on Tips from the Server Room. Bye for now. You just listened to Tips from the Server Room with your host, Jack. If you have any questions, please drop me a comment at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Thanks again for tuning in and downloading the shows. Now sit back, relax, and listen to the remainder of the music. We'll see you next week on Tips from the Server Room. So long.